Hello, you're listening to History of Asia. My name is Christoph. Today, we're going to talk about the situation in Iraq and Syria in the 50s and 60s. Now, this may seem like a random topic, but it may help us answer a big question. Do certain countries need a bloody dictator to avoid civil war? Think about that for a moment. And see if you changed your mind about it by the end of the episode. Imagine something. Suppose then someone told you, "You did a great job there, man. Machiavelli would have applauded." Would you feel flattered? Of course not. It's hardly a compliment, is it? And yet, in the previous episode, when I spoke about Hafez al-Assad and Saddam Hussein, I wondered out loud whether their actions would be approved by Machiavelli or not. Some of you will have found this an odd thing to consider. He's such a terrible guy, Machiavelli, so who cares if he would have approved of something or not? If he had, it's probably a bad thing, right? Well, Machiavelli may not deserve his evil reputation. True, he felt that the ends justify the means, but that's because he cared about that end goal so much. And this goal of his was not all that bad, to be honest. Consider this. During his lifetime, his native Italy was mired in chaos. Everyone was fighting everyone else. It was like, well, like Syria and Iraq during their respective civil wars. Now, this may surprise you, but Machiavelli really didn't like all this. What he wanted more than anything was for someone to stop the fighting and bring peace and stability, but this required that someone win the game, unite all of Italy under his banner. And here's the thing, he reckoned that this could only be done by applying ruthless, cynical methods, Machiavellian methods. Because, as he would say, any man who tries to be good all the time is bound to come to ruin among the great number who are not good. About a century later, another philosopher, Thomas Hobbes, expanded on this. He claimed that tyranny was the alternative to the state of nature. Now, state of nature, that may sound benign, but it would not exactly be a Garden of Eden. Rather, it was a war of all against all, in which life would be nasty, brutish, and short. The state of nature, then, was the worst of all possible worlds, according to Hobbes. He felt that people should opt for a monarchy instead. Now, if you disagree with that, and I bet you do, just wait till you hear what he thinks that the ideal king should be like. For Machiavelli, the ideal prince should be a fox to recognize traps and a lion to scare off wolves. He sure didn't want him to be loyal like a dog or sweet like a bunny. Hobbes did him one better, though. He believed that the autocrat should have the characteristics not of a lion, not of a wolf, not even of a far-sighted eagle. No, no, his ideal sovereign would be a leviathan. And in case you're wondering, a leviathan is a biblical creature, a diabolical fire-breathing dragon, also known as the monster of chaos. It's supposed to reside in hell, where it feasts upon the souls of sinners. Now, if you like royalty, that's one thing, I suppose. It's quite another to want the king to behave like the most frightful abomination ever to sprout from human fantasy. Sounds to me like Mr. Hobbes could use some therapy. What the heck is wrong with this guy, right? Well, if we find it hard to sympathize with either Hobbes or Machiavelli, that may be because, unlike them, we live in safe and stable democracies. Well, that is to say, looking at my listener statistics, about 90% of you do anyway, you might better understand where these philosophers were coming from if you lived in, say, Syria or Iraq. Because in these countries, recent history does seem to suggest that dictatorship is the likely alternative to anarchy, and vice versa. Just look at what happened when the local leviathans were dethroned. When Saddam's police state collapsed, civil war broke out. Ditto when the Assad regime lost control of the situation. The reason why these regimes do such horrifying things then is that only then will people fear it enough to remain peaceful and quiet. In other words, people are tortured in the dictator's prisons for the same reason why sinners are tormented in hell. Also, the devil's advocate might say. But is it true? When Saddam Hussein was held in custody, he was reportedly asked how long he thought he would need to calm the war of all against all that was raging outside. And he would have replied something like, well, just enough time to shave and put on some fresh clothes, perhaps. Not because the Iraqis loved him so much, mind you, because they were so scared of him. They would fall in line as soon as they saw that the Leviathan was not dead. It sounds unlikely, but I saw a documentary recently about the Iraq War, and there was this scene in which a young man testified how he used to hate Saddam with all his heart, but that now he wanted him back. Because under Saddam, he couldn't talk about politics, okay, but almost the minute that he left, his own life would turn into a nightmare. Considering what this poor man lived through, his attitude is perfectly understandable, I think. What I find worrying is that many influential analysts proclaim the same thing. That only the fear of an iron-fisted dictator can keep Iraq stable, and the same thing is often said about Syria. What is concerning about that is that the implication, of course, is that this is precisely what these countries need. These advisors can point to recent history as evidence, but to test their statements, we must also consider how things were before these despots came to power. Did Syrians and Iraqis surrender their freedom to a Leviathan so that he might save them from themselves? Had these lands been in a state of nature before the true strongman came to power? And if so, was that because the politicians of those earlier days were less Machiavellian than Assad and Saddam would be, less like a Leviathan? This is why we must step into our good old time machine and travel back to the 50s and 60s. Let's go. I should really add some special effects at this point, I suppose, but I just couldn't figure out what a time machine is supposed to sound like. So let's just agree we've arrived in the 50s and 60s, shall we? And I must say, at first sight, it looks like the doomsayers may be onto something. Because one quick gaze at a timeline tells us that these decades were indeed pretty turbulent, to say the least, in both Syria and Iraq. Leaders came and went in quick succession. Tribes, parties, army divisions, practically every part of society was sucked into a violent struggle for power. And all of these groups were in turn riven with factions and personal ties that formed and fractured at the drop of a hat, often quite subtly and beneath the surface. It can all be very hard to follow, to be honest. Now, every period in history is extremely complex, if you care to look closely enough. That I found this one so daunting will have something to do with the books that I consulted. Some of them I found not just exhaustive, but also rather exhausting. But I don't mean that as criticism, quite the contrary. It's just that to do justice to all the subtleties that are going on, this episode would have to be 10 hours long, no kidding. I don't want to do that, and you sure as hell wouldn't want to listen to that. Also, I want to focus on things that have a lasting impact, and most of these fleeting machinations don't really qualify, I think, so I won't try to cover all the events, not even the major ones. Instead, I want to see if we can find a method to the madness, something that could reveal the reasons why Saddam and Assad managed to reign for 3 decades, while their many predecessors could hardly find the time to make their maiden speech before being pushed aside. The first thing that grabs my attention is the changing role of the state. Iraq and Syria are basically creations of European diplomats. When they gained their independence, almost none of the inhabitants felt any patriotic affection for their new homeland. And it's not hard to see why. Just imagine someone from another continent tears your country apart, lumps some random provinces together, and then says, "There you go. Henceforth, you must consider yourself a loyal citizen of this new country." And yet, today, there are plenty of outspoken Syrian and Iraqi nationalists. So, how did that happen? I think the events in the 50s and 60s largely explain this. On the other hand, there are still many, both insiders and outsiders, who claim that Syria and Iraq have only ever been kept together by the threat of force, and that therefore it would be better if Shiites, Sunnis and Kurds went their own way. Peter Galbraith, for instance, an influential diplomat and policy advisor, has long advocated that Iraq be carved up. As he sees it, there should be an independent Kurdistan in the north, a Shiite state in the south, and the Sunni triangle in the middle. But to be honest, I am not entirely sure whether this would be an improvement. A free Kurdistan, for instance, would not be tolerated by its neighbors, who would likely invade to end it, and this could easily escalate into a wider conflict. Even if the neighbors refrain from occupying it, they could suffocate it with relative ease by blocking the transit of oil. The Sunni rump state in the middle would also be left surrounded and practically without oil. It would soon find itself so impoverished that the state would cease to function. Perfect breeding ground for jihadists, if you ask me. Finally, no matter where you decide to draw the new borders, there will always be ethnic Arabs stuck in Kurdistan, Shiites stuck in Sunni territory, and Sunnis stuck among Shiites. What becomes of them? Whenever states fracture along ethnic or sectarian lines, that usually bodes ill for minorities. It tends to lead to ethnic cleansing, revenge killings, and even outright war. Just recall the secession of Pakistan or of South Sudan. However, Mr. Galbraith is far from alone in stating that Iraq is an unnatural entity and should be broken up. The same has been said about Syria. But what exactly makes these countries so unusually artificial? Well, first consider the way that they came into being. This happened in the wake of World War I, when the British and the French tore up the Ottoman Empire. Before that, there was no Syria and there was no Iraq. Their current territories covered multiple Ottoman provinces, which is also why I decided to lump their histories together in this one series. Not because I think they should merge or anything, it's just that their histories often overlap. They emerged from the same empire, under somewhat similar conditions even, circumstances I mean, and in earlier times too, these territories were often part of the same political entity. For the Ottomans, the end came when they picked a losing side in the Great War. By the time it was over, British and French troops occupied Mesopotamia and the Levant. They had been aided by the Sharif of Mecca. In return for leading the Arab revolt against his Ottoman overlords, he had been promised his own Arab kingdom. However, France and Britain had also agreed to divide the Middle East among themselves. France would get Syria, including Lebanon, while Britain would get Iraq. Old-school colonization would no longer be palatable, however. Those days were over. The American president, Woodrow Wilson, for one, loudly spoke out for the self-determination of nations. The Soviets also railed against imperialism, to say nothing of the Sharif and his supporters. As a result of such counter-pressures, Syria and Iraq became mandates rather than colonies, meaning that the Europeans were mandated by the League of Nations to guide the locals on the path to independence. In the meantime, however, they would still call the shots. We'll discuss the mandatory period in the next episode. For now, suffice it to say that Iraq became nominally independent in 1932, while the French only left Syria after the Second World War. But although the mandatory period didn't last very long, it was long enough for the Europeans to put a deep mark on both these countries. For one thing, they could determine the form of government. The French, sworn republicans then as now, chased King Faisal, the son of the Sharif, out of Syria. This embarrassed the monarchical British who had promised a kingdom to his family. So as a consolation prize, they would welcome and install him as King of Iraq. The Europeans also determined the new country's borders. The French would split Lebanon away from Syria, while the British, for their part, made sure that Kuwait didn't become part of Iraq, even though it had been part of Basra province under the Ottomans. Kuwait would remain under British protection until the early 60s. After that, rival Arab states like Egypt would prevent a merger with Iraq. When it was eventually annexed by Saddam, it would be America that would drive the Iraqis out. Similarly, Syrian politicians were unhappy with the loss of Lebanon. It's not hard to see why. Both Lebanon and Kuwait were desirable because of their coastline. Iraq could now only access the sea through the Shatt al-Arab, the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates that flows into the Persian Gulf. But this is tricky because of the proximity of Iran. Kuwait also has lots of oil, while Lebanon had other economic attractions. And then there was the Zionist project in Palestine, another result of the conflicting promises that the British had made during the First World War. Considering all this, it's not so strange that Syrians and Iraqis were dissatisfied about the borders of their new homeland and didn't accept them. On the other hand, was this really so much more unnatural than the way most other nations have been shaped? It's not unusual for borders to be defined by diplomacy. Often they are drawn wherever the front line in a war happens to be at a time when a peace deal is reached. Centuries later, people on either side then often regard these borders as natural, even supernatural. There was a time in practically every country's history when it was seen as artificial, namely, when it was still young. For some perspective, let's make a comparison. Soccer fans will surely know RB Leipzig. This club was only founded in 2009. Red Bull, their sponsor, sent it flying. It immediately turned into one of the richest and best teams in the Bundesliga. The new club was widely detested, however, even in the city of Leipzig itself. It just didn't feel right that something so artificial could outcompete clubs with grandiose traditions. Now I get it, I can be a romantic about such things too, but on closer inspection, what is the problem with Leipzig precisely? Bayer Leverkusen, to name just one rival, is just as rich, and it bears the name of a company whose history is quite a bit darker than that of any sports drink. In fact, most big clubs are owned by disreputable entities. I suspect the real reason why Leipzig seems artificial is simply that it's still so new. The enmity towards it has died down already. Wait a few more decades and no one will remember nor care when and how it started off. That, I think, is the main difference between the artificial and the so-called natural in the world of sports, and so too in the world of nations. Examine the early history of France or England, and you will also see certain regions forcing their culture on others. Eventually, the provinces come to regard it as their own, and then it even becomes an object of passion. We've seen this in the series about Iran and Arabia too. I firmly believe that state building is always a top-down process, even if nationalists invariably claim otherwise. I've just read a book in which the author claims that in the case of Kurdistan, state building happens bottom-up. Now, admittedly, the powerful players in the region have done all in their power to discourage Kurdish nationalism, and it is blossoming nevertheless. But I think it's naive to think that it therefore emerged spontaneously. It never does. Kurdish leaders have gone to great lengths to promote and indeed create a standard Kurdish language, for example by sponsoring writers and storytellers. And they often did this for their own Machiavellian reasons. Is it so much more natural than if a state is formed to serve the purpose of a local sheikh rather than a foreign power? True, long before there were any Kurdish dictionaries, some Kurdish poets and other artists already fell in love with their Kurdish language. Or perhaps should that be their Kurdish dialect? Because there is no such thing as the Kurdish language. It consists of very diverse dialects, and not all of them are mutually intelligible. They even use very different scripts. That is not to belittle the Kurdish tongue. Every language has had to start off this way. And how could it be otherwise? Does anyone imagine people in Corsica, Normandy, and the Vendée all deciding to talk French all of a sudden? The point is, even if language were truly the essence of a nation, as many nationalists claim, then that on its own would still not be a solid argument why the Kurds should have their own independent nation. Their language divides them as much as it unites them. But perhaps it's not just about the language. Perhaps a nation is simply a group of people who regard themselves as such. In this regard, it's true that Kurds have felt distinct from Arabs, Turks, and Iranians for centuries. Some of them, anyway. I think their environment explains that to a large extent. They tend to live in or near mountains. The highlands have led to a distinct way of life. Understandably, this became an important part of their identity. But although this environment distinguishes the Kurds from others in a cultural sense, it also ensures their internal diversity.
mountains offer shelter to all sorts of minorities. As a consequence, there's arguably more separating the Kurds than uniting them. They are part of numerous religions, for instance, and very different ones. Most Kurds are quite tolerant in religious matters, but there are Kurdish jihadist groups too.
And the diversity goes further than just religion. Sulaymaniyya and Erbil have quite distinct social and economic situations and tribal attachments, and these are perhaps more important than language. So some might say that these distinctions, in fact, should determine the borders rather than language distinctions, which even did happen in the 90s when the Kurds split their autonomous region in Iraq in two. Finally, it's often noted that Syria and Iraq are artificial because they lack natural borders. There is something to this, but there are plenty of countries that lack natural borders and that nobody is suggesting should split up. The point of the matter is, I think, that identities are always multi-layered and changing, and to place one aspect of this identity on a pedestal is no choice of logic, just of emotion and politics. And I'm not here to pick sides. But artificial or not, when Syria and Iraq emerged on the world scene, most inhabitants were unhappy about their new country. Not that they longed for a return of the Ottoman Turks. Instead, they preferred a united Arab nation, like the Sharif and his sons had been promised all along. The problem about that for the Iraqi king and his supporters was that their kingdom was itself a product of British colonialism. The people were not able to forget that, for even after their mandate ended, the Europeans remained heavily involved in the affairs of their former charges to safeguard their interests. Suez crisis and all, that didn't help, of course. So anti-European sentiment was rife, understandably.
Meanwhile, the USA and the Soviet Union also tried to pull the Middle East into their orbit. This was the Cold War, after all. The CIA was accused of involvement in the overthrow of the first civilian government in Syria. This government had refused to come to terms with Israel or to allow a pipeline to be built to Saudi Arabia over its territory. The military dictator who overthrew this government, by contrast, proved very flexible on these issues. Syrians, of course, didn't fail to connect the dots. The Soviets also were not above meddling in the internal affairs of these countries, but they had big advantages over the Americans when it came to PR. Many Arabs had also come to detest capitalism, the economic system that was associated with the former mandatory powers. Nationalizations of foreign possessions seemed like an excellent idea, especially after Nasser had demonstrated that it could be done. Besides, Syrian and Iraqi society itself was extremely unequal. Many were clamoring for redistribution of riches, and particularly for land reform.
So, to summarize, Arab unity, anti-imperialism, and socialism, these were the rising forces in the post-World War era. These ideals powered the new mass parties that would gain prominence from the 50s onward, like the Ba'ath or the Renaissance Party. Its catchphrase would be unity, Arab unity that is, freedom from foreign meddling, and socialism. The Ba'ath was founded in Syria, but it quickly developed an Iraqi branch too, which explains why both Assad and Saddam would become members. But this party was far from homogeneous. Some factions prioritized one principle, other factions itinerated another. Certain members were right-wing, others semi-communist. There were devout Ba'athists as well as secular ones. Some would call for democratization, others for party discipline, others still wanted to concentrate power in the party's military wing. Predictably, these were the ones with army backgrounds like Hafez al-Assad. Saddam Hussein, by contrast, would arm party militants to overawe soldiers in the streets. And when it came to Arab unification, there was no agreement about how to bring that about either. Some wanted a merger with Egypt, others saw more in a union with another state, and still others only ever paid lip service to the idea. It would be the latter that would emerge victorious eventually, as the agenda became more nationalist and the party leaders of the two countries became openly hostile to one another. But we'll get to that.
All these differences often overlapped with rivalries about patronage and personal loyalties, which often proved more important. The other Ba'ath principles would also be sacrificed on the altar of power in the end. Once they got their hands on the state machinery, its leaders didn't want to give up their position for an Arab superstate, nor for a socialist utopia. But it must be said that for a while, their policies did benefit the downtrodden. Some land reform did take place, for instance. But by now, serious wealth is once again concentrated in a few families, and it's super dependent on Russia and Iran, so much then for socialism and freedom from foreign meddling. Finally, knowing what these states would become, we now find it almost impossible to imagine that the Ba'ath once supported democracy. To further complicate the picture, there were other parties championing these same popular ideals, and others opposing some or all of them. For example, redistribution didn't sound so attractive for those whose wealth it was gonna be that people were gonna share in. These landlords could count on the support of conservative clerics, who would argue that private property was holy under Islam. This would be one of the things that prevented the formation of a Shiite front, by the way. On this issue, the clergy would find itself diametrically opposed to secular-minded Shiites. Most Shiites were unenthusiastic about pan-Arabism too. Since no other large Arab state had a Shiite majority, those in Iraq feared that pan-Arabism was really meant to end their numerical supremacy in their own country. And perhaps this had occurred to some of their Sunni rulers. Shiites were often branded Iranians, which was then used as an excuse to expel them. And what about the Kurds? Not being Arabs, they could be forgiven for hoping that they would be left out of the Arab nationalists' projects. Well, that turned out to be wishful thinking too. No Iraqi government was prepared to give up its oil-rich regions, such as Kirkuk. In fact, Turkey had earlier tried to lay claim to the northern part of Iraq, the former Ottoman province of Mosul, where most Kurds lived. The government of Baghdad, dominated by Sunnis, wanted to avoid that at all costs, not just because of the oil there, but also because Mosul was the most Sunni part of the country. Without it, the Shiite majority would become overwhelming. The Kurds were occasionally promised some form of autonomy, usually by an opposition group that wanted their support, but virtually every Iraqi government would come into conflict with them sooner or later. Already, Kurdish resistance was led by the same family that still dominates their autonomous region in Iraq today, the Barzanis. In fact, Massoud Barzani, the preeminent leader of the KDP until recently, was born on the day that his father founded that party. That was all the way back in 1946. Politics in Kurdistan has always been a family affair. Barzani's guerrilla fighters were known as Peshmerga, which means those who face death, a name that speaks volumes about their attitude toward the government. Yet from the 90s onward, they made up the army of the autonomous region in northern Iraq, which theoretically would sort of make them Iraqi soldiers, because the reality would be rather different. Now, despite the fact that anti-imperialism, pan-Arabism and socialism were all fervently opposed by some, these were by and large the dominant political themes of the 50s and 60s. Most mass parties at least paid lip service to these ideals. Alas for the leaders of the Kingdom of Iraq, they could not serve these waves themselves. They depended on the support of big landowners and other notable families. The last thing that these people wanted was land reform, and instead of speaking out against the British, they even felt obliged to enter the Baghdad Pact, a regional alliance that included the old mandatory power. As for pan-Arabism, they were at best lukewarm about that, especially as it became clear that any large Arab union would likely be dominated by Egypt. Not only because this was the most populous country with the strongest army, but most of all because its president Nasser did champion all these ideals that were so popular all over the Arab world. Becoming part of such an entity would mean giving up your own position. Most politicians were not that foolish or idealistic. This largely explains why the dream of Arab unity never came true, even as most Arabs longed for it. Some Iraqi politicians tried to create a union without Egypt, which they would then dominate. Syria, for one, looked like a tempting target. But there were other obstacles to such a union, and these had to do with the fact that Iraq was in majority Shiite, again. Since the politician's most trusted clients were almost always members of his own tribe or family, and since these tended to belong to the same sect, the power of the state was concentrated in that sect too. In the decades after independence, in both Syria and Iraq, these were Sunnis. They had dominated the establishment under the Ottomans, and so they were already in a strong position when Iraq and Syria were created, while other groups lacked the education and governing experience. Under British protection, leading Iraqi politicians were mainly officers of the army of the Sharif, and these were Sunnis too. So in both countries, Sunnis controlled most key government positions in the 50s and 60s. But while in Syria and in most other Arab countries, they also made up the bulk of the population, in Iraq, the majority was, of course, Shiite. This made the union less appealing. Syrian Sunnis would see their numerical superiority melt away, while the Shiites in Iraq would see this as an attempt by their leaders to further marginalize them. They were often up in arms against any attempt in this direction. Most Sunnis relentlessly kept demanding an Arab union, however. Their demands became too loud to ignore, and this played into the hands of the champion of pan-Arabism, Nasser, who claimed to speak for all his Arab brothers. The Suez Crisis had made him the hero of the day in the wider region. His promises excited most people too. He would give them back the wealth of their country by nationalizing Western companies, and he would unite them by erasing colonial borders. Most scholars seem to think he didn't really seek a merger, but rather a sort of close collaboration that would allow him to set the agenda of other nations while avoiding to be caught up in their messy politics. But spare a thought for the other Arab leaders. If a foreign rival is more popular with your own people than you, you have a serious problem on your hands. How to respond? In Syria, the weak Ba'ath leaders and quarrelsome generals who pulled the strings at that point realized that they could be pushed aside at any instant, if not by an internal enemy, then by an expansionist neighbor. Syria had proven to be very vulnerable. So as a last resort, and in a very improvised manner, they invited Nasser to merge their two countries. Sectarian rifts were not an obstacle here because the Sunnis were politically and demographically dominant in both these lands. It seems that Nasser was taken aback by the unexpected proposal, but he could not afford to decline. He did hold all the cards, however, and so he could set any conditions that he wanted. The Syrian leaders had, of course, hoped for a prominent position in the new constellation, which would become known as the United Arab Republic. But Nasser had other plans. Syrian parties were disbanded. This should not have been surprising because Nasser had already disposed of political parties in Egypt itself. While Syrian politicians were overrepresented in the Union's assembly on paper, they had little actual say. Syria would be governed by appointees of Nasser. It was well on the way to becoming an Egyptian colony. Syrian notables rightly feared that Nasser would dispossess them, as he had also done in Egypt. Indeed, state intervention suddenly stalled, a serious U-turn from the previous policies. Therefore, it was perhaps not surprising that a Syrian coup, supported by the local establishment, put an end to their political union after just a few years. For those who had heard the episodes about Yemen or Abdullah Saleh, this will no doubt sound familiar. Before the United Arab Republic fell apart, however, the experiment had spawned a second, even weaker merger. For the crowned heads of the region, Nasser was an unambiguous threat. Their people wanted to join his republic too. So the Iraqi king sought an alliance with other monarchs. Now, the water between him and the Saudis was still too deep. They had driven his family from their original turf, after all. But there was another Hashemite monarchy nearby, namely in Jordan. The two crowned heads bundled their powers to form a so-called Arab Federation, a cooperation that was much looser than that name implies. Neither king was ready to cede his throne, of course, even to a cousin. So there were two pan-Arab projects competing with one another at that point. One leftist, republican and anti-Western, the other conservative, monarchical and pro-Western. The Arab Cold War at Pleiqua. But this cleavage does not exist in the preferences of their people. The policies of the pro-Western Kingdom of Iraq were very unpopular with most of the subjects, and with many army leaders too, who felt inspired by Nasser. These officers would call themselves the Free Officers, after the group that had deposed the Egyptian king and brought Nasser to power. While their armies were sent to Jordan to help defend it, they suddenly changed course and marched on Baghdad. They then overthrew their own monarch, and in a very violent way. The king's entire family would be lynched. Nuri al-Said, the domineering politician of the previous decades, managed to escape dressed as a woman, but it seems that his manly shoes gave him away. He was murdered on the spot and buried. His corpse was then dug back up by an angry crowd and mutilated until it was utterly unrecognizable. There are photos of this online, but I don't recommend looking them up. It's not a pretty sight. But it is emblematic about just how unpopular Nuri was, and more importantly, the things that he stood for. These were the polar opposites of the ideas that were in vogue at the time. Nuri was pro-British, anti-Nasser, and economically conservative. When Nuri and the king were assassinated, the Arab Federation died with them. Soon, the Syrians would also abandon the United Arab Republic, as had the Imam of Yemen, as we saw in the first series. These failed experiments dampened the enthusiasm for Arab unification. Nasser subsequently got stuck in the Yemeni swamp, and eventually he got steamrolled by the Israelis in 1967. That shattered the prestige of the great champion of pan-Arabism, and it would also prove a death blow to the movement itself. There was no one left who could conceivably unite the Arab world behind him now. As a rule, voluntary state mergers only occur if the weaker party is desperate, I think. After all, it means relinquishing your own position and trusting your fate to a rival in the vain hope that he will show gratitude, or at least mercy. You don't do that unless you feel you have no choice. Everyone drew lessons from the disillusionment of the Syrians. With the rise of Saddam and Assad, another voluntary union would become unthinkable. Both sat firmly in the saddle and did not tolerate anyone next to him, let alone above him, even if they did suspect each other of planning a hostile takeover. Besides, the regime in Syria would then become Alawite, unlike any other Arab state, which would be yet another obstacle for unification. Eventually, the artificial states, once denounced by almost all, would gain more and more supporters. The most of all from the ruling class and their clients. It was groups that were frozen out of power that would try to get rid of the state. It's not a coincidence, for example, that Iraqi nationalism really gained traction among Shiites only in the 2000s, when they had become the dominant group in the country. By contrast, disgruntled Sunnis would form the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. As that name implies, they would disregard the border between Syria and Iraq. Many of the group's leaders were once part of the deep state of Saddam Hussein, and they weren't calling Iraq a colonial artifact back then. Likewise, in the 50s and 60s, most politicians and revolutionary leaders that came to power in those years had tried to appeal to the masses by promoting pan-Arabism. But once they captured power in the artificial state, their position became intertwined with that state's survival. They could then harness its institutions to reward those who helped them gain power and whose support they would keep needing to hold on to it. Their backing was not unconditional. On the contrary, they expected to be rewarded right away. To satisfy their supporters, the leaders were ready to instrumentalize any aspect of state power. Officials were hired on the basis of loyalty. This in turn had consequences for how they behaved at their jobs. Often, they would use their powers to build their own client network. Thereby, anything the state did became openly political, even the most trivial. For example, licenses could be granted or withheld simply to reward a client or sabotage a rival. Such experiences supposedly don't encourage a genuine love of country. There is a saying ascribed to Winston Churchill that I think loosely applies here. If you're 25 and conservative, you have no heart. If you're 35 and still not conservative, you must have no brain. Now, a cynic might retort to that if people become more conservative with age, That's because they have acquired a house, a car, and money in the bank. They have more to lose and hence become afraid of change. So too with the new leaders of Syria and Iraq. But unlike the ruling cliques, most Middle Easterners still had little to lose and still demanded change. In response, the ruling parties went out of their way to retain an image of idealism. But this was unconvincing, and as a rule, any time a party took power and entered government, it was faced with demonstrations, if not outright revolt. To keep the public under control, they depended on violence, and therefore on those that wielded this violence. This put army officers in a position where they could dictate policy, or in some cases, become dictators themselves. Iraq's government was the first in the Arab world to be overthrown by its own army in the 30s. This had alarmed serious politicians. They recognized that this could easily happen to them as well. Therefore, they deliberately kept their armed forces weak. Ironically, this indirectly led to the first coup in independent Syria. Its military weakness had contributed to Syria's utter humiliation in the war against Israel. As always, after the defeat comes the blame, and the civilian leaders intended to heap it on army leader Husni Zaim. That was unfair, not only because his army was not up to the task, he'd had to fight with one arm tied behind his back. The Syrians feared that the Jordanians might take advantage of the situation if their whole army would be engaged against Israel, so many troops were forced to stay behind. Zaim didn't accept the blame. Instead, he seized power himself. Turns out, keeping your army weak offers no safeguards against coups. Just because you can't defeat a modern army doesn't mean you can't capture a few men in suits. Once the officers had taken power, they in turn feared they might be deposed by others like them. So they constantly purged the military. This would in turn encourage actual conspiracies, which led to more purges, etc. This all ensured that the Syrian army would remain ineffective, despite its growing size. In the 5 years preceding the Six-Day War, Syria had no less than 5 chiefs of staff. When this war broke out, it performed accordingly, which resulted in the loss of the Golan Heights. After this new fiasco, the public would demand a respectable army. No longer could it be kept small and divided. Then, a certain Hafez al-Assad became army chief, and then president. This enabled him to fill the numerous vacancies that were opening up with his own clients. His sect, the Alawites, had always been overrepresented in the armed forces. But while in 1970, 2 out of 5 army divisions were commanded by an Alawite, by 1992, the number of divisions had grown to 9, of which no fewer than 7 were led by an Alawite. Or so I read in John McHugo's book Syria, A Recent History. This meant that Assad could feel more secure than his predecessors. Militarization could continue, generously sponsored by the Soviet Union. Syria regained its pride in the Yom Kippur War of 1973, and again in the Lebanese Civil War. Naturally, Assad would take credit for this. It partly explains why political instability ended with him, I think, which no doubt was a relief for many. His long-term dominance in itself became a source of charisma and made the opposition fatalistic. The same would happen with Saddam in Iraq. Assad's coup was in fact the outcome of a power struggle within the local Ba'ath Party, more precisely between the military wing, which Assad controlled, and the civilian wing, controlled by his former boss. As I explained last episode, the two fell out over intervention in the conflict between the PLO and the Jordanians. And while the party congress condemned Assad, his friends in the army would come to his rescue. The outcome of this confrontation, I think, is emblematic for how things had evolved lately. Both the army and the Ba'ath Party had also acted as a springboard for minority groups like the Alawites. The French had filled the Syrian army with such minorities, since they distrusted the Sunnis, who made up the majority of the population, as well as most nationalist leaders. But even after independence, ambitious figures from these disadvantaged groups would continue to join the armed forces in large numbers.
because there were few other attractive career paths open to them. In almost every walk of life, every other walk of life, you needed connections with higher-ups, and these were usually Sunnis who favored their own sect. For those who had such connections, it seems that a military career was rarely on the bucket list. This is how Alevites like Assad would make their career. In both countries, Kurds had also come to power through army coups earlier. This way, members of formerly marginalized groups could get their hands on the levers of power. However, they had little governing experience, and neither did people in their network. Given their life experience near the bottom of the food chain, they often felt attracted to socialist policies, such as fighting landlordism. Nationalization would also be popular, and sometimes prove lucrative. This left-wing profile also helped elicit Soviet support. In general, during the 50s and 60s, the Soviet camp was winning the Arab Cold War. The tide would turn in the 70s when Nasser's successor, Anwar Sadat, would switch to the American camp. This made Syria all the more valuable to the Russians as a remaining ally. As for Saddam, he also found himself in the Red Camp for a spell, but his oil wealth enabled him to chart his own course, which is ironic, as it was the Russians who had helped get the oil production off the ground. Syria, however, was in a more precarious situation. It could not afford to lose its powerful defender. And in hindsight, a cynic might say, perhaps Saddam could have used some protection too. In the 50s and 60s, Iraq did pivot towards the USSR, leaving the Baghdad Pact, for instance. But though this didn't lead to a close relationship with the Russians, it did have long-lasting consequences, because it brought the Iraqis in conflict with their powerful neighbor, the Shah of Iran, who was a faithful US ally. The Shah started making trouble on the Shatt al-Arab waterway, endangering Iraq's only access to the sea. This experience made it acutely aware of its vulnerability in this regard. Perhaps partly as a result of this, when Kuwait declared its independence in 1961, Baghdad let it be known that it should instead become part of Basra province once again, as it had been under the Ottomans. As you know, Iraq would act on this in the early 90s. The Iraqis also started calling the oil-rich west of Iran by the name Arabistan instead of Khuzestan. They claimed that because there were so many Arabs in that region, it should be part of Iraq. Here is another threat that Saddam would in time act upon. So you see that even Saddam's crazy foreign adventures were already present in the minds of Iraqi politicians in the 50s and 60s. The same could be said about Assad's obsession with Israel and Lebanon. I think we may conclude that Saddam and Assad were all in all not that different from most politicians in the 50s and 60s. Almost every aspect of their behavior was already present in some form. Many of the leaders of that time also tried to form a dictatorship, complete with a personality cult. They too were ready to deport, execute, and torture opponents. They too tried to bring the party, bureaucracy, every other aspect of society under their personal control, concentrating power in the hands of their small inner circle. Even Saddam's irresponsible foreign adventures were foreshadowed in the 50s and 60s, when Iraqi politicians were already eyeing Kuwait and Khuzestan. The reason why Assad and Saddam survived so much longer then lay not so much in their greater political skill, but in the different circumstances under which they had to operate. In the 70s, state income rose spectacularly, mostly for reasons that were out of their control, like a sudden spike in oil prices. The man who happened to be in charge at that moment could spend much more on public procurement, state recruitment, public investment. And while in well-functioning countries, state activities are supposed to benefit the common good, in Iraq and Syria, they were first and foremost tools for gratifying people and occasionally punishing them. So more power for the state meant more power for those that controlled it to consolidate their position. Although politics in the 50s and 60s had been tumultuous, for most people, times had been worse. In contrast to the conservative governments dominated by the happy few, the new mass parties at least tried to win the people's favor by spending money on public services. There just wasn't as much to spend, as the oil boom was not yet in sight. Finally, more and more people were becoming supporters of their nation. if only because they had grown up in them. They had started considering them as part of their identity. Saddam and Assad also didn't have to worry about foreign rivals anymore that might claim the mantle of pan-Arabism, like their predecessors had. And patriotism made at least part of the population more reliable, and especially among the soldiers. The rest could still be kept in check with the threat of force, which also became easier as more money poured into the security services. It all reminds me of a game of musical chairs. When the music stops, you can catch a chair if you're determined or lucky enough. But before you know it, the music starts again. By the early 70s, however, Hafez and Saddam had captured the last seat, through ruthlessness and cunning, but perhaps most of all by being on the right place at the right time. They then turned it into a throne and tried to make sure that no one would ever start the music again. And we already saw how they did that. They intentionally turned their country into a house of cards, only held together at the top by personal ties. So if their downfall was followed by civil war and anarchy, that's because they had made sure that it would. What else could you expect? For a Leviathan, it is known, is itself a monster of chaos. The choice between anarchy and tyranny is therefore a false dilemma, I think, a false lesson that we must refuse to learn. If you have another idea, feel free to let me know. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. In the next episode, we'll see who drew the map of the modern Middle East, and we'll discuss whether the current mess is still their fault. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.